show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life, do you hear me? Give my creation life.
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Get countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast area.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said.
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
You betcha. Guy James here with you. I'm Guy James and you're not. Don't you forget that. Welcome, everybody. Glad to have all of you along with us here at the Guy James Show this afternoon. Proud member of the Head On Radio Network. And we're here to give you a great show today, I promise you. And if all goes well, and I see no reason why it shouldn't, we're going to have two great interviews today. Mr. Dar Jamil, everybody's familiar with him. He's an independent journalist who spent over 8 months reporting from Iraq. He's got a new book coming out pretty soon, Beyond the Green Zone. And isn't that what we all want to hear? Beyond the Green Zone. Don't give a damn what goes on inside the Green Zone. That's the dog and pony show that they always like us to see. And also, in the second hour, we're going to have David Enders. David, of course, was with us, I'm trying to remember exactly when, maybe 3 weeks ago, maybe four, I'm not sure. David is a freelance journalist who's just returned from Iraq, where he spent a lot of time going all over the country, and he's another guy who didn't spend his time, as they say, inside the wire in the Green Zone. No, he was out and about with the Iraqi people, finding out the truth about what is going on there. And that's what this program is all about, is about truth. And that's why we bring you gentlemen like Dar and David. They don't have a political dog in the fight. They're freelance journalists, and the only thing they care about is finding out and delivering the truth to you and to me and to people all across this country. That is what a real journalist does. That's not what the networks are doing today. That's not what the big corporate media is doing today. They don't give a damn about the truth. They really what they care about is what sells. And that's what you see on the tube every day. That's what you read the newspapers every day. That's why you read those stories in the New York Times by that O'Hanlon and what's that other guy here recently. They bring back a story that they think will sell, that everybody read. They'll sell advertising and increase the bottom line. That's what it's all about. That is not what David Enders and Dar Jamil and some of the other guests we've had on this program are about. They're about truth. And that's what this show is about, and that's my main concern every single day when we open the microphone on this show and send the broadcast out to you, that it is true and it is as accurate as we can possibly be. And so we're going to deliver today on that, and we hope you'll call all of your friends that are interested in hearing the real story. You know, the administration tells us they're going to give us the real story here coming up. What is it, the 14th of next month when General Petraeus comes home? Bushy Boy's good friend David, as he calls him, General Petraeus, is going to give an accurate representation, they say, of what actually is happening in Iraq. And I think you're smart enough, and I know I'm smart enough, and hope to God most of the people in America are smart enough to read between the lines and know what's happening. You see what is going on here already. We had some indication of it yesterday. They've started a media blitz now. I'm sure many of you saw Ari Fleischer on Hardball yesterday with Mike Barnicle, a disgraceful, disgraceful performance by Ari Fleischer. First of all, it is no secret to any of you that I have utter contempt for Ari Fleischer in the first place. And to see him get up and lie his ass off on that program yesterday and pretty much look at the American public and say, screw you, we're smarter than you are, you don't know anything, we're going to shove this propaganda down our down your throat. They've got $15 million behind him, Ari does, with this new think tank of his, this propaganda machine that they put up. $15 million coming from the right. And it's pure political propaganda to try and sway public opinion to the side of keeping this war going on and on and on. Did you see the ad that Ari Fleischer and his, I can't think what they call that group that he's with now. They put out an ad, and it's a fear and smear ad, just like always. That's what they thrive on, is fear. And in this ad, pushing the war, they once again showed the crash of the airliner into the Twin Towers, and to his credit, Mike Barnicle asked him how many Iraqis were on that plane, Ari, and Ari said, well, it's not about 9/11. Well, if it's not about 9/11, and you know, and they always say that, well, it's not about 9/11, we're past 9/11, we got to worry about now. No. No, you see, when we find out that you've lied to us, and you've told one prevarication, one untruth after another, and when you've propagandized the American people, what happened then does matter. The events leading up to this war do matter. They always did. But because of your record of lying to the American public and misleading the American public, we're not going to forget the events leading up to the invasion of Iraq. We're not going to forget that the Bush administration trumped up charges and went in there willy-nilly. We're not going to forget that there were no Iraqis on any of those planes. And then they had the temerity to show a disabled veteran in this ad who'd lost a limb in Iraq. And how's this guy supposed to feel? I think you all know how he's supposed to feel. He does not want to feel that he lost a limb, lost a leg in Iraq in vain. Of course he doesn't. He wants to believe his commander-in-chief. Isn't that the natural thing to do? To want to believe in your commander-in-chief? And again, they ask Ari Fleischer, what was that soldier's name in that ad? And he didn't even know the name of this soldier. Here's a guy that's heading up this project, this propaganda project, Ari Fleischer, and he didn't even know the name of the soldier that they're using for this massive propaganda campaign. $15 million they're spending on this ad. It was absolutely disgraceful. But then whoever said Ari Fleischer was anything other than a do-anything, say-anything lackey for Junior Bush in the first place, that's been my opinion of him since day one, and I know most of you feel that way as well. It's disgusting. I had a chance last evening and today. At Showtime yesterday, I had not had the time as of yet, but I have now had a chance to go over Junior Bush's speech to the, I keep forgetting whether it was the VFW or the Legion. I think it was the VFW. I really had a chance to go over and dissect that speech that he gave yesterday. And you talk about a disgraceful display. That was. Now, I don't. And you know this, I don't expect the President of the United States to be an expert in all things. That wouldn't be fair. But I do expect the occupant of the Oval Office to have at least a decent knowledge of American and world history. Maybe at least the equivalent of your average junior high kid. And as you know, I have long said that Junior Bush isn't exactly an intellectual giant, but after hearing his speech yesterday, damn. Could it be more apparent that the guy is an utter, complete fool? And I am sad to say that about the President of the United States, but it is the truth. I think we all know that. He isn't satisfied now with being a private fool. Oh, no. He has to go before the TV cameras and show everyone that he isn't the intellectual equal of an average 12-year-old. And you have to wonder, I mean, we've known all along that he's an idiot. Well, now I wonder, what about his speechwriters after watching that display of his yesterday? What about it? What's wrong with them? Is this White House just full of idiots? I'd hate to think that. And the propaganda that comes across, I've never seen anything like it. He used the word democracy 21 times in his speech yesterday. You know, they could put together a big, long speech for him, and it would go something like this. Democracy, democracy, freedom, freedom, 9/11, democracy, freedom, 9/11. Just keep saying those over and over and over again. That is what he does. That is the message, after all. That is how you propagandize people. You tell the big lie, and you say it over and over and over again, and hope that the populace is stupid enough to accept it. And I don't want to mention any names, but evidently they are. He had this to say about Pol Pot and the Cambodian Khmer Rouge. And let me quote Junior Bush on this. He said, the defense strategy that refused to hand the South Koreans over to a totalitarian neighbor helped raise up an Asian tiger that is a model for developing countries across the world, including the Middle East. And then Junior Bush went on to compare the current Get Out of Iraq movement in this country to what happened at the end of the Vietnam War, which I'm blown away by this. And lest any of you forget, what was it, about a year ago? Well, listen to this, and then let me go on and tell you about the speech yesterday if you didn't all see it.
Do you see, as some of your critics do, a parallel between what's going on in Iraq now and Vietnam?
No.
Why?
Because there's a duly elected government. 12 million people voted. They said, we want something different from tyranny.
That's Junior Bush himself. His own words. No, there is no parallel between Iraq and Vietnam. Not that long ago. I think about a year ago. Sometime in 2006. And he went on in his speech yesterday to try and compare what happened, the current Get Out of Iraq movement in this country to what happened at the end of the Vietnam War in 1975. And he said, and let me quote, many argued that if we pulled out, there would be no consequences for the Vietnamese people. The world would learn just how costly these misimpressions would be. 3 decades later, there's a legitimate debate about how we got into the Vietnam War and how we left. Whatever your position in that debate, one unmistakable legacy of Vietnam is that the price of America's withdrawal was paid by millions of innocent citizens. Bush said that. And he went on to mention reprisals against our allies in Vietnam, the people that worked for us in Vietnam and worked with us in Vietnam, the Vietnamese citizens, the Vietnamese refugees, and he mentioned the massacres in Cambodia under Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge. Folks, if you watch that thing carefully, and if you've studied your history, and if you've lived through that time, if you didn't live through it, if you have studied that time, this was an assault on a rational mind. At that point in his speech, when he said that about the Khmer Rouge, my jaw dropped. I was truly stunned that this dolt of a president would make such an ignorant statement. He was actually blaming our country for the Cambodian genocide under Pol Pot. Now, you can call me naive, but everything that I know, everything that I have ever read about Pol Pot's rise to power is that it was the result of the United States' war policies, not by withdrawing from the region. Pol Pot, if it hadn't been for the U.S. war policy in that area of the world, Pol Pot would never have come to power. And another little thing that Mr. Bush conveniently forgot, or is completely ignorant of, is the fact that it was the commies, after all, who put a stop to that Cambodian genocide. It's apparent after listening to that speech yesterday, that disgraceful speech, that plea for vindication for his illegal and immoral acts and gone to war in Iraq. It's so evident that Bush does not have a clue as to the actual history of that whole event that was Vietnam. And he went in front of the entire world yesterday and proved his stunning ignorance. And I wrote down something else he said. He said, and I'll quote him again, "There was another price to our withdrawal from Vietnam, and we can hear it in the words of the enemy we face in today's struggle, Al-Qaeda." In an interview with a Pakistani paper after the 9/11 attacks, bin Laden declared that the American people had risen against their government's war in Vietnam. They must do the same today. And Bush goes on to say, "Here at home, some can argue our withdrawal from Vietnam carried no price to American credibility, but the terrorists see things differently." So let me get this straight, Junior Bush. What you're actually saying here is the war protesters of today, and your administration and your lackeys and minions have been saying it all along, the war protesters of today are giving aid and comfort to the enemy, and the war protesters of the Vietnam era caused today's terrorism. That's what you said. I've heard of rewriting history, but usually it's done by somebody with at least a rudimentary knowledge of the subject. And I have to admit, from all that I've seen, Bush's ramblings yesterday left almost everyone, except those 29 percenters. It left almost everybody else shaking their heads. And I happen to know a couple of hardcore right-wingers that were just ashamed of that speech yesterday. Because does it not insult the Republican base to know that their boy, their beloved leader, that some of them had followed to hell and back, is trying to pull off such a con job? Does that not insult them? Does it not bother them that the Bush administration feels that they can go public and say anything they want and their flock will believe them? Jesus, I would be absolutely livid were I a conservative Republican right now. I'm livid anyway, but at least it's not the guy I voted for saying this crap. Just amazing. And please do keep in mind that the Junior Bush has been letting it know lately, and we'll talk more about this a little later on in the program, but the administration has been letting it known to be known that they wouldn't exactly be sad if the Maliki government failed and someone new was put in his place. Do remember that the same fate fell upon President Diem in Vietnam with the blessings of the United States government. Now, lest you get the wrong idea, I do not think that Maliki is an effective leader. He's far from it. But I do think that Jesus or Buddha or Muhammad or Confucius, any of them could be leading that country right now, and they'd be in the same pickle as is Maliki. And as weak a leader as Maliki might be, do remember he's dealing with an almost impossible situation. I think Saddam proved that the only way to have peace in that country right now is with oppressive, brutal tactics. Someday that may change. I hope it will. It should change. But it is what it is right now, and Maliki is not the biggest problem in Iraq. In my opinion, in fact, Maliki's leaving would probably only cause longer delay in bringing about peace and democracy in that hellhole of a country. And allow me to be fair here. I don't feel much better about the Democrats right now. They're doing a political two-step after a couple of them have announced that maybe we ought to give Junior and his master plan more time to work. The Democrats aren't working on principle. They're working on politics and only politics, and that doesn't make their position any better than Bush's, in my opinion. Why can't everyone understand that the only thing Bush is trying to accomplish here is to hand the ball off to someone else, and if somebody else gets tackled behind the line of scrimmage, then, oh well, things were okay when I gave him the ball. It's not my fault. And it's true, the Democrats are in disarray, and none of the leading candidates, have an answer that's going to satisfy the Democratic voting base. I know that at least that none of them have an answer that will satisfy me. And I consider myself an average Democrat, and I sense a growing satisfaction by Democratic voters on this issue. And yes, the popularity of the Congress is at historic lows right now, but it's not because of anything they've done. It's because of the cowardly Democrats and what they have not done. Namely, they have not had the guts to stand up to the most unpopular president in modern times and demand an end to this war. Not only demand it, but force the end of this war by cutting off the funds. They act like they're powerless. They are not. You know, you got Republicans like Ari Fleischer that can spend all of the millions of dollars on TV propaganda they want, but you'll never convince me that ending this war is not the popular thing to do. There's an astounding shortage of guts on the part of the Democrats right now. I have never seen such political cowardice in my life. So on the one hand, we've got the propaganda, and on the other side, we've got the politics right now, and I am just so damn sick of this after watching that mess yesterday of a speech of his. I was so ashamed that a president of the United States would display such an astonishing either A, lack of knowledge, or B, try and be the master propagandist. It's ugly. 866-546-5254. Let's go to the phones. Hello, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, Guy. This is Phil in Daytona Beach.
Hi, Phil.
I'm sorry for calling so much this past week, but everything you're talking about is the 9/11 report, my hair is on fire.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And Ari Fleischer, damn it. He should be one of the first in line for being put in jail for this whole Iraq thing, lying this country into this illegal war. And you know, I know you got the guests coming on soon, but all of this whole Iraq is planned to go on for years, and we've got to disengage from the way this discussion is being framed. And instead of focusing on solving the Iraq problem, I really wish we could bring the discussion back to, I'm not talking directly to you, Guy, but I mean as a nation, we could bring this discussion back to the initial deliberate lying to start this war, illegal occupation, and I really think if we could put more focus on that as a nation, people forgot that, you know, to some degree that these bastards flat out lied, and there's evidence from here until next Thursday, man, to demonstrate that they have. And I think if we can get back to that, then people say, well, what the hell are we doing here in the first place? Get the kids out of there. You know, I think we've got to get back to that, and that is the primary thing. These bastards need to be put in jail. Books have come out, George Tenet's book, you know, Dick Durbin, you know, saying, well, I knew the intelligence. These guys should all be in jail, and they're flat out writing it in ink and selling the books to people, saying that, you know, hey, we lied, we knew it was a lie. And the Congress is not demanding impeachment because they don't want anything to do with it because they're in on it.
They're just complicit. There's no doubt that they're complicit. They cannot indict the president without indicting themselves. There's just no way.
So it's up to us, man. It's up to we the people to shift the discussion. They want the discussion on Maliki and the Iraqi government and the surge and Petraeus's report. You know, the Democrats as well as the Republicans and the media, which serves the same masters as the Democrats and Republicans, they all want the American conversation on Maliki, Petraeus's report, you know, how's the surge going, you know, will the Democrats get some backbone, blah, blah, blah. And we've got to disengage from that. Those of us that are, you know, shows like yours, Guy, and the guests that you're going to have on are schooling us, the people, that you know, to the truth. And it's incumbent on us, the people, to take the ball and run with it, because we're the only ones left that the troops have. Everything else is controlled by the war makers.
Well, we outnumber them. We outnumber them maybe 500,000 to 1.
Yes.
And yet, they're...
Because we still haven't risen to the occasion, Guy. The American people are still in the talking mode. Damn it, every day we're talking and saying, man, this is all wrong, and, you know, this guy lied, and it's all a farce, and every day that we're spending that energy just repeating ourselves and talking about it is another day that this genocide is going on. You talk about Pol Pot genocide, we're committing genocide right now. American troops are committing genocide with the blessing of the American people. And why do I say the blessing of the American people? Because the American people have yet to stop it.
Yeah, they just, it's frustrating.
The American people have yet to stop it. So it is going on with our blessing. The buck stops with us.
Yeah, it does. I agree.
Well, thanks, Guy. I'm really looking forward to these guests.
Thank you, Phil.
Okay, bye-bye.
We're complicit. We've mentioned that many times. Phil's mentioned it. Other callers have mentioned it. I've mentioned it. I've harped on it day in, day out. What do we do? You know what I think we need to do. You know, I think we need to establish a foothold in the media. And you also know that I think that we're horribly lacking in doing that. Democrats, by and large, certainly not everybody, but Democrats, by and large, are all mouth and no ass, all hat and no cattle. You know what I'm saying. By and large, that's the nature of the beast. Ari Fleischer and friends wanted to put up a propaganda campaign this month to help keep this war going on. The administration probably went to him. Who knows who started this? But they said, you know, we want to spend $15 million on ads in August and the first week or so in September. We want to spend $15 million bucks. Let's call a few of our friends. They called a few of their friends. Yeah, I'm in. Call another guy. I'm in. Next thing you know, they've got $15 million bucks to run these ads, these pro-war ads. The Democrats? Forget it. Forget it. It bothers me to no end. It really does. And you know how I feel about it, and you're probably tired of hearing me talk about it, but I see one liberal radio program or progressive, I hate using that word, but they've forced many Democrats into calling themselves that. Simply because they do control the media from the right. and they've backed the Democrats and the liberals into a corner to the point where they've put their own rules of the game in and made most liberal Democrats afraid to call themselves liberal Democrats. Well, I'm progressive. Let's face it, that's the reason for that. You know damn well the Democrats would never have come up with that word, we're progressives. You know they would never have said that had they not been backed into a corner by the Republican with their massive, massive media machine. It would never have happened. But there's the liberal Democrats cowed over in the corner. Oh, please don't call me liberal. Oh, please, Mr. Republican, please don't call me a liberal. Oh, God, no, please don't. That's where we're at. And I hate to keep harping on it, but that is where we're at. Day in, day out. That's where we're at. Going to take a break. Be right back.
This is Chevy Chase. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war and lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge and tortured, used illegal weapons and targeted civilians. Let's get them out of here. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor House Resolution 635 for an investigation.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days, so surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
Checking each other out. And no
Hey, we're back with you here on the Guy James Show. Just reading a few notes from some of my Buckeye friends. As many of you know, I'm a former Ohio resident, a devout Buckeye to this day. And what a mess. These unseasonable rains have brought to Northwest Ohio, and how startling it was to turn on the news last night, the national news, and see little towns that I'm very familiar with, Shelby, Ohio, and Findlay, Ohio, and Cary, Ohio. That's in my old; those are my old stomping grounds, and to see those on the national news with people up to their ass in water. Unbelievable for this time of year. It really is. All those small towns, Bucyrus, Ohio, Upper Sandusky, Findlay, Shelby, Cary, that whole area, and they're just inundated with water, and a lot of people, homes ruined. It's a sad thing to see on the evening news last night. Don't often see a little rural Ohio make the news like that, but seems like everybody takes their turn sooner or later. Welcome to the Guy James Show. We're glad to have you along with us this afternoon. If you'd like to call us here today and give us your opinion, why, please do so. 866-546-5254. And if you have an unlimited calling plan and want to call on your nickel or got those minutes to spare, 941-876-6896. Before we went on the break, we were talking about Bush's unbelievable speech yesterday. And I'll talk about that just a little bit more. I see someone on the chat room. And by the way, a lot of you listening, visit the Head On Radio Network chat room, okay? Great group on there. Somebody on there says, Shelby is my hometown. Cobweb said that. Well, the home of the Shelby Whippets. Larry Siegfried of the great Ohio State National Championship basketball team in 1960 or 1961 from Shelby, Ohio. So, yeah, I know about Shelby, the Shelby Whippets. We were talking about Bush's obscene speech yesterday, and how they're starting to beat the drums now. The Bush administration, they're looking for they're looking for somebody to blame, and it looks like the blame is going to all fall on Maliki's shoulders, and maybe that they can get him out of there. They can buy some more time. And here's how they're planning on doing it. You know, you've heard of Haley Barbour. He's the new governor of Mississippi. Well, not new, been in all of last year, year before as well, former GOP big shot, still a GOP big shot. There's a lobbying firm called Barbour, Griffith & Rogers, and it's long been a powerhouse as a GOP lobbying firm. Now, apparently, American politics are just too small time for them. BGR, Barbour, Griffin, and Rogers, they're trying to influence Iraqi politics as well. That firm, which, by the way, was started by Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour, has been promoting Ayad Alawi. You all remember that name. The one-time Iraqi interim prime minister, who over the weekend published an op-ed in the Washington Post calling for the parliamentary overthrow of the current prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki. And what this was a trial balloon for American support to try and put Alawi in there again. And, of course, he's promising the non-sectarianism and the stability like he could do anything about it. Alawi, as you all know, has decades-old ties to the CIA, which makes him a known quantity to the U.S. officials during their time of, and I know, extreme frustration with Maliki. So there you have it. We have a U.S. lobbying firm trying to install them, their own puppet in there once again. And I really cringed as I watched that speech yesterday. And I don't want to belabor the point about the speech yesterday, but I don't think really enough of it can be said. That was a watershed moment, in my opinion, for the Bush administration. Perhaps the American public, hopefully, will sit up and take notice now, finally. put down the beer in the evening and watch the evening news and watch it and say, what the hell is this about? In his speech, and I know most of you heard it, Bush cited Graham Greene's classic Vietnam novel, and it was called The Quiet American, which... Well, somebody wrote me today and was telling me their opinion of it. Said it's a contemplation of the road to hell being paved with good intentions. I most definitely agree. But I don't think it was a very smart thing for Bush to mention to people that book, The Quiet American, because they just might read it, and if you do read it, you're going to take a look at the Bush administration and take off your rose-colored glasses and go, oh, my God, what was Bush thinking when he went into Iraq? And you do have to wonder. You absolutely have to wonder. What is the, you know, the entire White House staff, what are they thinking? You know, for... I don't know how many years, 2, 3, 4, I'm not sure, since the very beginning. They've run and hid for any comparison to this war and the Vietnam conflict. And now he's comparing the two? I think it's a big mistake for him. And you would never convince me. Never. Convinced me that George Bush read the book, The Quiet American. You'd never convince me that he's read anything of substance. Never. I just don't think it happened. I don't think he has the intellect to read a book like that and understand it. Do you quarrel with what I said there? Do you think Bush does have the intellect to read a book like that and understand it? Do you think he has the intellect to read any book of substance and truly understand it and comprehend it? I don't think so. And I hate like hell to say that about the President of the United States, but I think it's true. It's absolutely true. And now we've got this national intelligence estimate that came out today, and the Bush administration released it. It's an update to the National Intelligence Estimate, and the title of it, if you've seen it in the news already, is called Prospects for Iraq's Stability. And in it, of course, they're saying there is some security progress, but political reconciliation is elusive. Well, gee whiz, we didn't know that. And this National Intelligence Estimate, which offers the coordinated judgments of the intelligence community, it says, and I quote in it, a measurable but uneven improvement in Iraq's security situation. But it goes on to caution that there remains a lack of political progress, which I think we all agree is just as, if not more important, than the military progress. You can take over the entire country militarily, and if you don't have a political process in place to do the job, the moment you walk away, the whole house of cards will fall down. I think there's no question of that. And some of the main things this new national intelligence said is there's a decrease in Baghdad violence. Okay. It says there's the violence is, this is just absolutely what we've been saying along. It says the violence to remain high over the next 6 to 12 months. And notice they didn't go past the 12 months. Now they've stretched it out to 12. You know, we've been going on these six-month Freedman units, and a lot of you know what I'm talking about, Freedman units. You always, oh, just 6 more months. Just 6 more months. Give us just 6 more months to do this. And when is 6 months? Well, just 6 more. I know what I said, but please, just 6 more. Now they're 6 to 12. What'll it be 12 to 18 the next time? I think so. But The outlook is from the NIE that the national government is going to become more precarious over the next 6 to 12 months. Imagine that. Our own intelligent estimate is saying the government there is going to become more, and that's the direct word right out of the NIE, more precarious over the next 6 to 12 months. It says, and I quote, the Iraqi government will become more precarious over the next 6 to 12 months because of criticism by other members of the major Shia coalition, Grand Ayatollah Sistani and other Sunni and Kurdish parties. The strains of the security situation and absence of key leaders have stalled internal political debates, slowed national decision-making, and increased Maliki's vulnerability to alternative coalitions. And it also goes on to say that the horrible Darja Mill will talk about this coming up right after the top of the hour. The refugee crisis is going to continue on over the next 6 to 12 months. Huge refugee problem. Some of the neighboring countries ready to burst. Now, some of the neighboring countries won't even let any more refugees in. It's a humanitarian crisis of major, major proportions. You wonder how they're coping. I know a couple of million people have left that country. A couple million more would. People with money got out long ago. It's just a horrible situation. 866-546-5254. We'll be back in a moment.
What is the deal with the American people?
If you don't want to see checkers put down, you'll submit to my reasonable demands.
This is President Gerald Ford. Please help me. I've fallen.
I don't recall.
Read my lips. No new offspring.
Saddam Hussein, tear down this hospital.
In celebration of Weekly Radio Address History Month, WeeklyRadioAddress.com presents a noted presidential radio address from the extended White House radio archives. This week, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt from February 21, 1942.
My friend, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. That's why I have proposed a convenient, easy to read, and color-coded fear alert warning system. Yellow indicates that you ought to be only marginally afraid. Orange tells you, be pretty afraid. Red means that the best course of action is to run for your lives in unreasoning, unjustified panic. One never knows when the Nazis or the Japanese might strike. The entire world changed on December 7th, 1941. We now live in a world in which foreign enemies might do us great harm at any moment. Boom! That might have been just such a moment just then. In addition to the color alert terror level, which I will change at random and issue daily, another way in which I will compel you to live with the constant and intense fear of another imminent attack by enemy forces is this. I intend to speak to you in what I call a fireside chat every week, positioning myself next to a raging fire in order to strike fear into the most primitive part of your brain, the heart that trembles before the awesome destructive power of fire, the most elemental of forces. I will keep this fear burning as long as I live, and you will cower at my every command. I bid you good day.
La 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 la.
Dear Mr. President, come take a walk with me. Let's pretend we're just two people and you're not better than me. I'd like to ask you some questions if we can speak honestly. What do you feel when you see all the homeless on the street? Who do you pray for at night before you go to sleep? What do you feel when you look in the mirror? Are you proud? How do you sleep while the rest of us cry? How do you dream when a mother has no chance to say goodbye? How do you walk with your President, were you a lonely boy? How can you say no child is left behind? We're not dumb and we're not blind. They're all sitting in your cells while you pave the road to hell. What kind of father would take his own daughter's rights away? And what kind of father might hate his own daughter if she were gay? I can only imagine what the first lady has to say. You've come a long way.
Yes, dear Mr. President. Hey, we got just a few minutes before the top of the hour. We've got about 4 minutes and 45 seconds or so. Got to tell you about an email I just got, and I have to ask your opinion on it. Should I or shouldn't I? Two interesting emails. The first one, let me read it to you. Guy, this is an email to the Guy James Show from Mr. Elliot Bundy from the JoinRudy2008.com. Guy, as the Giuliani campaign spokesperson for Florida, I wanted to touch base with you and offer a member of our campaign leadership, or myself, to come onto your program soon to discuss our campaign activities. The past few weeks have been fantastic, a fantastic period for the campaign, as national and in-state polls continue to show Mayor Giuliani leading the field for the Republican nomination, and we've announced some key Florida endorsements. I'm always thrilled to do radio in the same state, and I'm happy to be on at your earliest convenience to discuss Mayor Giuliani and why we are going to win Florida. Oh. Should I or shouldn't I? I think it'd be a good idea to have him on, don't you? Let's take a vote. Everybody hold up your hand. Yeah, let's have him on. We'll just all be real quiet. We won't say anything. And maybe they won't figure it out, and we'll invite him on. We have what an upbeat email from this guy. And speaking of Rudy Giuliani, you know, he talked, and I want to thank Stuart for sending me this, talking about, well, we beat up on Georgie Bush about his speech yesterday, but he wasn't the only one to talk about this. Rudy Giuliani just wrote an article in Foreign Affairs. Although many are upset by Junior Bush's remarks, the Vietnam analogy was used by Giuliani before it was used by Bush in his speech. It seems to be part of a Republican strategy and appears that Rudy is advised by the same people as Bush. And here's the quote from Rudy. What's interesting about Rudy's articles is that he is proposing that we actually won in Vietnam. Rudy didn't get the reaction Bush did, but he should have. And he went on to say, America must remember one of the lessons of the Vietnam War. Then as now, we fought a war with the wrong strategy for several years. And then, as now, we corrected course and began to show real progress. Many historians today believe that about 1972, we and our South Vietnamese partners had succeeded in defeating the Viet Cong insurgency and in setting South Vietnam on a path to political self-sufficiency. But America then withdrew its support, allowing the Communist North to conquer the South. The consequences were dire, and not only in Vietnam, numerous deaths in places such as the killing fields of Cambodia, the newly energized and expansionist Soviet Union, and a weaker America, the consequences of abandoning Iraq would be worse. Oh my God, Giuliani, oh my God. You could not possibly believe what you just wrote there. You just couldn't. You could not be that ignorant of history to think we were winning that war and then just decided to up and leave. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It turns out that Giuliani is, I gave him credit. I can't stand him. I can't stand him. He's a weasel of the highest order. But it turns out that he is he as stupid as George W. Bush? Can that be? Is that possible? He thinks we were winning the Vietnam War. He actually, in that statement, is claiming that we were winning the Vietnam War, and all of a sudden we just decided we better leave and get out, and then the North Vietnamese took over everything. That's what he's saying. Oh. Oh. And I know he's as old as I am. He's got to remember this whole mess. Got to remember it. Oh, my God. Oh. Hey, we're going to listen to the news. We're going to have Dar Jamil on right after the news. Don't go away. You're listening to The Guy James Show here in the Head On Radio Network. Music director Billy Shears. And we'll be back right after the news.
This is the Quality News Network. The latest National Intelligence Estimate report cites, quote, measurable but uneven improvements in Iraq's security situation, and went on to say Iraq's political leaders lack the ability to govern effectively. The intelligence report also cites the need for a fundamental shift in Iraqi political factors if the country is to be stabilized. Pakistan's Supreme Court has lifted the imposed exile of a former prime minister ousted by current leader and U.S. ally General Pervez Musharraf. Nawaz Sharif was removed from power 8 years ago by Musharraf, who has been criticized lately for his inability to control Islamic militants. Sharif and another former prime minister are expected to run against Musharraf in upcoming elections. The newly appointed Army Secretary said he will not lengthen deployment times for soldiers in Iraq. Pete Guerin, a former Texas congressman, said he sees no possibility of extending troop deployments beyond the current 15 months. Adding longer tours put too much stress on soldiers and their families. Humanitarian workers employed by aid groups receiving U.S. funding will be required to submit to background checks. The screening process is intended to identify potential terrorists and will involve thousands of people working for groups such as Save the Children, CARE, and the International Rescue Committee. In Utah, the sixth and final borehole will be drilled in the Crandall Canyon coal mine. Mine owner Bob Murray says he will then feel he's done all he could to rescue six men trapped since August 6th. Friends and family of the trapped workers want efforts to continue. Previous attempts to rescue the men have resulted in no signs of life and the death of three rescue workers. The New Jersey State Attorney General has ordered law enforcement officers to notify federal immigration authorities whenever a lawbreaker is determined to be an illegal immigrant. The order follows the execution-style murders of three Newark college students by six suspects, one of which was a criminal illegal alien from Peru out on bail for assault, weapons charges, and raping a child. Firefighters say cooler temperatures and lighter winds are providing some relief for wildfires in Montana, Idaho, and California. Some of the fires have been burning as long as 2 months, and thousands of acres have been charred. In Ohio, the state's governor has declared a state of emergency as residents flee rain-swollen floods. At least 40 people have died in the past week throughout the Midwest. And in Blacksburg, Virginia, an advisory panel investigating the Virginia Tech massacre says in the future, authorities should identify and monitor students seen as disturbed. The group also recommends increased campus security. You're listening to the Quality News Network. Coming up next, science and business.
What are you doing?
Fertilizing the lawn. Do you want to help?
No, not really. But didn't you just do that last week?
Yeah, I did. I want the lawn to be really lush and green this year.
Dad, what happens when those sprinklers come on?
We give the grass a good long drink.
That water runs off with the fertilizer in it and gets into the bay, where it can harm the fish.
So what should I do?
Use just the minimum recommended amount. The lawn will be just as green, and you'll be saving our ocean.
Taking care of the marine sanctuary is your duty. From Maos at Monterey High.
Hello, I'm CHP Officer Felix Isararas. Law enforcement officers throughout the state are committed to removing drunk drivers from California roadways before they kill or injure themselves, or worse, an innocent victim. Right now, local law enforcement and the CHP are conducting DUI checkpoints to find drunk drivers and keep California roads safe.
Always designate a sober driver. And if you see a drunk driver on the road, call 911. A message from the Office of Traffic Safety and California Highway Patrol.
The UN is warning governments that deadly infectious diseases are spreading unchecked faster than any other time in history. The World Health Organization predicts an epidemic capable of killing millions will strike sometime within the next couple of decades. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission has recalled more than 300,000 Chinese-made children's products found to be contaminated with lead paint. Included in the new recall are books, tops, pails, and jewelry. Attorneys for British Airways will plead guilty today to conspiring with Virgin Atlantic and billing customers for fuel surcharges on international flights. The U.S. Justice Department is expected to fine British Air $300 million. Toll Brothers announced its quarterly profits tumbled nearly 85% to $26.5 million. America's largest luxury home builder cited recent troubles in the credit industry and the sluggish housing market. Lehman Brothers says it intends to close down one of its home lending units and lay off 1,200 employees. The Wall Street firm said the move would result in a $52 million quarterly change. Financial Times reports a large Western oil company has offered to pay $700 million for Iraqi oil assets in the Kurdish territory. The newspaper says the proposal indicates oil companies are willing to invest in the region despite severe security difficulties. Light sweet crude is trading at $69.51 a barrel. Gold is trading at $667.80 an ounce. And on Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones is down 34 points. The Nasdaq is down 14 points. There's more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com.
Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life! Life!
This is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Begin countdown.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered a restricted broadcast area. You have entered a restricted broadcast area.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you've read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody. Glad to have you all along with us this afternoon. And without further ado, let me get right to it. I don't believe in teasing people to stay with us here in the program. I told you we were going to have Dar Jamil with us at the top of the hour or right afterwards, and he is with us. Dar, welcome to the program once again.
Good to be here, Guy. Thanks for having me.
I always enjoy having you on the program, and I'll tell you why. We get tired of hearing spin on events in Iraq, and so many times we hear from people, that politicians in particular, that go over there and get the dog and pony show at the in the green zone and come back after a few days and tell us, my oh my, aren't things just great in Iraq? I'm able to go to the market and buy rugs. I'm able to go out and do anything I want. We hear this over and over again, and it's not as if we want to hear just bad news. We just want to hear the truth, that's all. And I know that truth is what you're all about, and I want to welcome you to the show, and we're looking forward to hearing the truth from you today as just how things are and what do you think an honest General Petraeus will say, and so forth. Dar Jamil, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Guy.
How long has it been since you were back over there?
The last time I personally was in Iraq was February 2005. I've continued to cover it between then and now by working closely with Iraqi colleagues that I was working with while I was on the ground there. So many Iraqis have left, but I still have a couple that I'm working with that are actually able to get around a bit enough that we're able to still do stories.
Actual Iraqi citizens or other newsmen, journalists?
Right. They're Iraqi citizens, but they're also journalists.
I see. Isn't that a particularly dangerous occupation in the country of Iraq?
It's extremely dangerous, probably the second most dangerous behind someone working directly with occupation authorities or the U.S. military there. It's the most dangerous place in the world for a journalist from any country to work, according to all of the major journalist support organizations like Committee to Protect Journalists and Journalists Without Borders, et cetera. Reporters Without Borders and several others. There have been more journalists killed there than throughout the entire Vietnam War or World War II.
I don't see how an Iraqi as a journalist there could possibly win. If he writes one way, the Sunnis hate him. If he writes another, the Shia hate him, or some of the militias hate him. If he says anything about the government wrong, they hate him, or the Americans hate him. There's no way to win, is there?
You're exactly right. That's why it's so dangerous. Aside from just the generalized security situation that affects everyone in Iraq, really exactly what you just said is the primary difficulty. That it's impossible, even if a journalist there were to take one particular side or another, that's not going to guarantee them any safety whatsoever. So these are people that are working very covertly, doing their best not to let people know. They're journalists, except when it's absolutely necessary, and it's definitely a situation where anyone working there as a journalist is certainly taking their life in their own hands.
At least in this country, no matter what you write coming home from there, you're going to have about half of the people that agree with you and half of them that hate you or disagree with you. But there, it seems like it's split up into many different factions. It'd be hard to ever get more than probably 10-20% of the people on your side, no matter what you wrote.
That's very true. Earlier on in the occupation, it was pretty clear there were basically two camps. Either you were more with the United States and the military and you were pro-occupation, or you were with the majority of the Iraqi people and the Iraqi resistance, and you were critical of the occupation. But now that's quickly devolved into, exactly as you said, there's so many different militias, each one with different agendas, so many different political groups. There's the U.S. military, there's covert operations, there's intelligence agencies from basically every country in the region and many others from around the world operating in Iraq. There's private mercenaries like Blackwater USA. So you can just go on down the list of there's basically every group there. And at this point, the vast majority of them don't want to have any media whatsoever.
We see these reports that there are as many private contractors in Iraq, possibly a few more, than there are American troops there. Is that something that's obvious when you're there?
It is, actually, because along with a very notable U.S. military presence on the ground, it's very easy to see the tanks and the Humvees on the streets and soldiers at checkpoints and their helicopters and jet fighters in the air. But along with that, you do see the most commonly used vehicle by these mercenary companies are these big white SUVs, either GMCs or other types of SUVs. They have bulletproof glass and usually armor in them, and oftentimes they have a tail gunner. They'll have someone in the back of the vehicle with a big metal plate in front of them, and they have a machine gun peering out of it, and they go usually in twos, threes, or fours, racing through the traffic in Baghdad, oftentimes running down sidewalks and cutting in between lanes of cars because they don't want to have to stop because they fear, and legitimately so, an ambush. But these are a very, very well-known presence, and they're also very infamous for firing their guns randomly. Anytime they're frustrated in traffic, they'll oftentimes just start firing their guns to make cars move out of the way, and oftentimes it's civilians, and this is well documented, and you can even find videos of that right now online of these contractors riding around just shooting at random Iraqis just for the sport of it. But they also have their own helicopters. In fact, it's well known and well cataloged in the book by Jeremy Scahill about Blackwater, and I've seen it with my own eyes that they have their own small Kiowa helicopters that they use to fly around and run cover for their own patrols and their own little convoys of their SUVs going through various cities. So they do have a very visible presence, and of course this is well known to Iraqis as well.
Well, they don't have any accountability, do they? I mean, we know some of the things they've done. Are they being held to account for any of it, any of the people that are doing these things wrong?
They don't, and that's an extremely important point because the U.S. military, by comparison, for example, they have the Uniform Code of Military Justice, there's the Constitution, there's, you know, many things they've been sworn into to operate under as with guidelines and things to keep them legitimate and things that are there so that we're able to bring them to account when necessary, so that things like court martials and military law and then at the end of the day the U.S. Constitution can be used. But these private mercenaries literally operate outside of all accountability. There's nothing to be used to bring them to account. In fact, of all of the mercenaries in Iraq, and right now on the ground, there's an estimate of between 50 and 75,000 armed mercenaries on the ground in Iraq, making them by far and away the second largest member of the so-called Coalition of the Willing. But of all of the hundreds of thousands of armed mercenaries who have cycled through Iraq and worked there on the ground between the beginning of the occupation and now, there's literally been charges brought against two of them. One was a mercenary working in Abu Ghraib prison who was charged with having child pornography on his computer, And then there was another one who was charged for murdering actually another, actually an Iraqi man on a base, and he was promptly flown out of the country before Iraqi law could be applied to him. Those are the only two cases in the entire occupation of private contractors having even the possibility of consequences being applied to them.
And, of course, we hear the stories of the pay of these, I guess you'd call them mercenaries, private contractors. They, I wonder how much resentment by the American military personnel there is toward these people. They probably make as much in a week as some of these fellows, our military people, do in half a year. And they seemed, in many cases, to be better armed, better protected.
Well, that's correct, and there have actually been instances of open violence between Marines. I know one instance in particular where Marines in Fallujah were there. They were on the ground talking with some Iraqis, and then one of those convoys I mentioned before of some mercenaries drove by shooting randomly at Iraqis, and it just so happened that Marines were on location when it happened, and some of that gunfire came very close to the Marines on the ground. The Marines promptly ran down these mercenaries and brought them into custody and had them shipped out of the country. And part of that, I mean, aside from the obvious reasons of being fired at, but part of that is festering resentment of the fact that an average mercenary on the ground in Iraq, a Westerner mercenary, that is, let's be clear about that, is making anywhere between $300 and $1,500 a day on the ground, where the average U.S. soldier in Iraq might be making, I'm going to guess, roughly between maybe $40,000, maximum $50,000. So, yeah, there is great resentment. They see that these people are there. They're basically doing a similar job, except they have a lot more freedoms and a lot more options available to them. And yet they're being paid, I don't know the exact math, but certainly we can say upwards of five, six, seven times more than the average soldier on the ground.
And wouldn't it be a logical conclusion to think that the American military personnel in many cases would pay themselves what the consequences for the actions of these mercenaries, these illegal acts that you say running around shooting at Iraqis, that can't do anything but make the Iraqi people hate all Americans, not just the ones that were shooting at them in as private contractors.
That's a really good point, and it's another general cause of the resentment that's so common now amongst U.S. military personnel and these mercenaries, is that the mercenaries riding around shooting at random people, killing people, just generating massive resentment against all occupation forces, then, of course, those who have to pay the highest price for that are the actual U.S. military. They are the most visible. They are the ones going out on more operations, manning checkpoints, there for over a year at a time in many cases, whereas these mercenaries oftentimes go in for 1 to 2 month stints and then they leave, and then they can bail on their contract and leave the country altogether anytime they want, whereas U.S. soldiers don't have that option. And so basically they're there to clean up the mess caused many times by these mercenaries on the ground. For example, it was the Blackwater USA group where the four mercenaries were killed in Fallujah on March 31st, 2004. And then the White House decided to siege the entire city of Fallujah, usurping the command of the Marine commander in charge of Fallujah at that time, who actually argued against an attack, an all-out attack on the city. But because of Bush administration ties to these mercenary groups, specifically Blackwater USA in particular, who's a giant lobby group for the Bush administration, the entire city was sieged and hundreds of soldiers were killed, thousands were wounded. And that was all because four Blackwater USA mercenaries were traveling around in Fallujah without a map.
Terrible problem. I want to shift gears a little bit. I know that you've studied and reported considerably on the terrible problem of the Iraqis that have been displaced into the other countries, those that are trying to get out of the country. What can you tell us about the people that have fled the country, that particular situation in that general area, people out in refugee camps in other countries and people that are trying to leave the country? How big of a problem is this?
It's a massive problem, and actually, if we look at the scope of the refugee crisis, a refugee crisis that's described now by the group Refugees International as the fastest-growing refugee crisis on the planet, if we look at that compared to the amount of media coverage it's getting, it's rather shocking. It's almost impossible to convey back here in the United States to people the scope and the gravity of this. We're talking about Iraq being a country of, when the invasion was launched, of 27 million people. That number is now down under 24 million people. That's for two primary reasons. One, over a million Iraqis now have died as a direct result of the invasion and occupation. And then the second main reason is that over 2 million Iraqis have fled the country altogether. And now upwards of almost 3 million people are internally displaced refugees within their own country. So we're talking about a refugee crisis now that's pushing 5 million people being displaced from their homes. That's due to the massive and horrible security problem in Iraq. That's also due to the chaos caused by the occupation, massive U.S. military operations, and then also sectarian militias and death squads that are going around now and basically cleansing neighborhoods based on people's confession of Islam, whether they're Sunni or Shia, and sometimes based on their ethnicity, whether they're Kurdish or not. So it's becoming a countrywide phenomena. And every day now, thousands of people are being forced out of their homes in Iraq as we speak. And between 30 and 50,000 every single month are streaming over the border into Syria. And then when we carry the problem in Iraq of the refugees outside of the country, Syria now is basically the only country in the world that is maintaining an open door policy for Iraqis, and how that's and that's a good thing and should be commended. But then how that's translating now is Syria is a country where now almost 10% of their entire population are Iraqi refugees, and these are people that are not allowed to work. There's not enough health care, education facilities for them. Syria, we're not talking about an economic powerhouse here. We're talking about a country that had 20% unemployment before this crisis even began. So the refugee influx is driving up the cost of everything. It's starting to generate resentment amongst many of the Syrians. Property values are being driven up. And, of course, the Iraqis are there with nowhere to go because there's no other country in the region or in the world that's freely issuing visas. And if most of them that I interviewed when I was there a couple of months ago said, you know, we have no choice but to stay here and try to figure out a way forward, because if we go back to Iraq, we'll be killed.
Well, who's feeding them?
Well, most of them who have left are basically living off what savings they had. Many of them have friends in Syria. There is a substantial percentage of the population in Syria that are really just reaching out and opening up their homes, doing what they can to help them. Another aspect, Red Crescent is playing a big role in trying to help refugees. UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, is there, although they're grossly under-budgeted and understaffed to deal with the magnitude of the problem and openly admit to that. I interviewed many people with UNHCR when I was there, and they said, you know, last year our budget basically gave us less than a dollar per refugee to try to deal with this. We've had an increase in budget, and for this year it was increased up to about $60 or $70 million. But that still translates out to about $10 per refugee, not including the overhead of UNHCR. So doesn't take a mathematician to see that that's a massive crisis. There's not nearly enough funding or personnel to try to deal with it. So this is why it's so critical. The short answer to the question is, many of these people are high and dry, and there isn't anything there to help them.
Dar, I've only got 2 or 3 minutes left, and I need to ask you the all-important question, the news we're getting out of Iraq. how much can we depend on it in the mainstream media, the propagandizing taking place by the Bush administration? We got this Petraeus report coming up. How much can we trust what we're hearing on the airwaves and the TVs and the newspapers nowadays?
Most of the mainstream media reportage of Iraq is propaganda disguised as journalism. It's really not accurate whatsoever. There are a few exceptions. I don't want to totally generalize here, but I encourage people to seek out alternative sources, go to more localized radio stations such as this one, and use the Internet and read as many different news sources, alternative and foreign, about Iraq, and shy away from most of the reporting being done by American news agencies, and especially the main TV networks and cable networks like CNN and the so-called news station Fox.
It's tragic. I guess this is one of the casualties of something like this. I forget who said it. One of the first casualties of war is the truth, and it appears that the truth has taken a terrible beating here in the media. That's why we depend on people like you. We've got our friend David Enders coming up in a few minutes to talk about it. David has spent considerable time there as well. But we have to depend on freelancers and independents like you to bring us home what we want to hear. And all we ask is the truth. That's all. And it's not that hard, is it? I don't understand why the terrible propagandizing. And I guess it's for that good old bottom line for the major corporations. It's sometimes hard to understand. I think people like Walter Cronkite and people that were real journalist, Edward R. Murrow and so forth, probably don't appreciate, and Murrow wouldn't appreciate what's happening today. Dara, I want to thank you so much. We've got to have you back again. You've got so much to say, and we have so little time to say it. Always a pleasure to have you on the program and inform our listeners of the truth of the situation with your extensive knowledge of the area and your great reporting. We appreciate it very much. And your website?
Oh, well, thanks very much, Guy. And, yeah, folks can read my work at dar.org. It's dahr.org.
And you got a book coming out soon.
I do. It's coming out on October 15, published by Haymarket Books. It's called Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq.
Great. We'll look forward to it. Well, we know we can expect to find the truth in it. Ladies and gentlemen, Dar Jamil. Dar, thank you once again.
Thanks very much, Guy. My pleasure.
I'd love to have him on for a couple of hours a day for about a week if he had the time. An interesting guy, and it's always a good thing to find out more tidbits of the truth. This refugee crisis is something to be reckoned with over there for sure. We're going to pause for a quick break, and we'll get David Enders along with us, and we'll be right back.
Freedom without, try to catch the deluge in a paper cup. There's a battle ahead, many battles are lost, but you'll never see the end of the road while you're traveling with me. Hey now, don't dream, it's over. Possessions are causing suspicion, but there's no proof. The paper today tells of war and of waste, but you turn right over to the TV page. Hey now, don't dream, it's over. No, they won't win.
walking again to the beat of a drum, and I'm counting the steps to the door of your heart. Only shadows ahead, barely clearing the roof, getting down, feeling of liberation and release. Hey now,
live radio is always so much fun. Trying to get David Enders on the phone, our next interview, and for some reason we cannot get through right now. We'll see if we can get him rounded up sometime in the next few minutes here. I certainly hope so. 866-546-5254. That's 866-546-5254. Always a pleasure to have Dar Jamil on the program with us. He has so much to say about Iraq, and it is interesting to talk to the people that have actually been there. Like we mentioned so many times, we hear about Iraq from politicians that have gone over there and been wined and dined and given the dog and pony show by the brass, and they come home seeing exactly what the brass wants them to see. And they come home and tell us exactly what they want to tell us. And like Dar said, you don't know, you know what you're hearing. It's just it's a miserable situation. It truly is. Where was I here? Always a little off schedule when we try and get through to somebody and we don't. Funny story. We talk about serious things on the show most of the time, but. Typical of the South, and I'm not picking on people from the South, but I don't know any place else where this might happen, and particularly Alabama. Have you seen this story? You know, in Alabama, you can buy guns all over the place. You can buy fireworks all over the place. You can blow yourself to the hell and back with firecrackers, fireworks, guns, all that. You can do all that, but you want. But and you can get the guns, you can get the fireworks and all that. But sex toys are banned. And now the state law banning the sale. I love this story. In Alabama, you can sell guns on any street corner, but you can't sell sex toys. That's right. Alabama is a vibrator-free state. You can go across state lines and buy sex toys in Georgia and Tennessee and carry them home, but you can't buy them in Alabama. And don't you know, that's gone before the Supreme Court, possibly. And so the Supreme Court is going to have to... let the citizens of Alabama know whether they can have sex toys or not. Only in Alabama. Let's head on over to the phone. Hello, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, this is Dave Enders calling.
Hi, Dave. We're live on the air. Glad you got through to us.
Sorry about that.
Well, clocks aren't always... we're not always where we need to be when we need to be, and I'm sure glad that we got you in today. Thanks very much for giving us a call back.
Thank you for having me.
You're home from Iraq?
Yep.
You've been home for what, maybe two weeks now, 3 weeks?
A week out of the Middle East.
Okay.
Been out of Iraq for almost 2 weeks.
And and I've read a little bit about your journey home and so forth. It must be. Well, how do you feel as an independent journalist being home? Are you anxious to go back? Are you glad to have a respite from that hellhole for a while? How do you feel about it?
Well, I probably won't go back until next summer. I'm actually teaching all this year, so I have sort of a built-in few months off at least. And I was filming on this trip, and it's so expensive to work there that really the only way to do it independently was to do TV stuff. It's the only thing that pays enough to cover the costs. And so conversely, though, it's extremely, extremely hard to film. So I I'm glad I went, and I think I was able to get some stuff that I don't think has been coming through very strongly in some of the reporting. But it's a very frustrating place to work. It's an even more frustrating place to live. And it's very frustrating that it's reverting, in a sense, to a police state and the way it was under Saddam. So when you're trying to work, you have virtually no access to really everyday life of Iraqis. I mean, I was able to go visit some of my friends' homes.
The last time we talked to you, you were in Baghdad, and we spoke to you live in Baghdad, and you were able to travel around some, but it's a tough chore getting around Baghdad, right?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of neighborhoods are under the control of different militias, and you have to coordinate with whatever armed group controls whichever neighborhood you're trying to go to in order to go there. So you're there at their pleasure. And being an American journalist, that's a very loaded thing. So it's hard enough to convince them that, one, you're not such a big target that they don't want you there at all, and that, two, that you could possibly be covering a story that they think is worth taking the risk on their part to have you covering. Your other options are obviously to hire lots of security of your own or to go with the American military. And none of those choices, no matter how you're doing it, you're only getting, at any given time, one sort of side of things. And then obviously when I was going to my friends' houses, I was going without the camera and not to report, but to just see them.
And that's when you get the plain unadulterated truth thrown in your lap, when you're out without your camera and...
Right.
Tell me.
Exactly. People are very nervous of cameras. They're very nervous around journalists and reporters. You do get... And the candid stuff comes from, for instance, the way, you know, like in order to get down to Najaf, we had to go with one of the very heavily armed Iraqi political parties, the Supreme Iraqi Islamic Council, took us down to Najaf. And we wanted to go interview another political leader from a different party. And we knew our way around Najaf, and Najaf is pretty safe. It's a little police state of its own. And we said, okay, thank you. You know, we're going to wander off the tour for a minute, and we have an interview set up over here. And it almost started a little civil war in Najaf between the two parties. These guys didn't want us talking to the other guys. So, you know, things like that aren't captured on camera, but they're extremely telling in how people are running things and how people view. And these people are, you know, nominally political allies. In truth, their militias are fighting each other. And so you just really get a sense of how fractured things are and how dangerous it is.
Well, you've been home long enough now, and you must realize that what we are hearing in the mainstream media now, and we're hearing a big push by the Bush administration, we're hearing the word progress a lot. You've been there recently enough to know whether there's progress being made or not. What do you have to say about progress being made in Iraq?
Well, there's virtually none, politically or otherwise. All of the major issues right now that are trying to be decided in Iraq politically are the same issues that have been issued since 2003 and still remain unresolved. How the oil is going to be distributed, the extent to which the central government is going to have control over the provinces, the Kurdish autonomous areas, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no progress being made. Those are no closer to a resolution, unless it's a military one, than they're no closer to a political resolution than they were 3 years ago. As far as the violence and actual control of Baghdad, the casualties, if you just go by statistics, with the addition of 30,000 troops there, the casualties and the car bombings are the same or slightly higher than they were 6 months ago. So if you look at, despite the influx of 30,000 extra troops, the guerrillas have managed just as much violence or a little more. So in one sense, you could say that the violence is up considerably. Militias are in greater control of Baghdad than they were 6 months ago. There's no question about that. And you have a situation in which the U.S. is now arming different militias. It's arming the government and essentially the Shiite militias via the government. And now it's starting to arm Sunni tribes and Sunni militias, which they're calling protection forces or concerned citizens. Or potentially the U.S. military is arming both sides of a civil war.
Well, David, so let me ask.
Kind of progress.
Let me ask something here. What does a guy like you say, an independent freelance journalist? What do you say to the senators Lindsey Graham and John McCain and Carl Levin and John Warner that come home and say, "Hey, things are really looking up"? Well, you've been there a lot longer than they have. But here these are political leaders in this country. What does a guy like you say to them?
I don't think I can say it politely enough to have it on your show. The same thing the troops say. It's who are these guys? You know, what do they know? Exactly, what do they know? They spent a day, 2 days in Iraq, surrounded by extremely heavy security. It's racist. I mean, for an American politician to go and spend a day with troops and say everything is going fine in Iraq, I couldn't speak with one. I could not find a single Iraqi who was optimistic. Things were not getting markedly worse and going to get markedly worse. There's a story in the New York Times today about the extent to which militia groups are in control of the power stations. You have Baghdad is running out of water, it's running out of power, and so predictably you have armed groups fighting for control over the resources that are there. And you know, Senator McCain, Senator Graham, Senator whoever are full of whatever you want to have them be full of.
Does it appear to you that the U.S. government is setting up Maliki to be the fall guy in this whole thing and going to put Alawi back in again or somebody of his ilk that they can control? How do the Iraqi people feel about their government if they feel they've got a government at all?
That's, I think the end of your statement is a little closer to it. They don't feel that they have a government at all. They know that it's beholden to the U.S., And really, it exercises very little power outside of the green zone. So it'd be interesting if the U.S. did support some sort of coup. To what extent there would still be support for that government?
That's my question. Would it matter? I said earlier today, in one of my opening statements today, about this problem there, that it doesn't appear to me that if Jesus or Muhammad were running the country right now, I don't know that that it could be in any better shape.
Potentially, if Alawi, for example, came in and. And I mean, the only way that this happens is if somebody starts talking seriously about reconciliation and repealing some of the de-Ba'athification laws that removed basically anyone who was associated with the former government from their job. You know, low-level functionaries and the military. But at this point, the Shiite militias that have built themselves up are so distrustful of those people. That it seems unlikely any Iraqi leader at this point could have the nationalist credentials and credibility to bring the two sides together. I just don't see it. I mean, you have a best case solution is that people stop fighting, but that doesn't mean that Baghdad is probably going to go back to being a mixed city like it once was. I think probably Beirut, when it split into different sectarian enclaves during the war, still looks like that. It's never reverted. And then that war ended in 1990, and Beirut is still very divided in the sense, you know, which neighborhood is Christian, which neighborhood is Sunni, which neighborhood is Shiite. So I don't see any political leader, any U.S.-backed government really at this point having any fighting chance.
It's been my opinion for a while now from what I know, and I have not been there. And I do not talk on a regular basis to the citizens of that country. But the Ba'athist, for example, you talk about the de-Ba'athification. Are many of the folks that were in the Ba'athist Party in the same position as were some of those who were in the Nazi Party during the Second World War, that they got caught up in this because it was the politically expedient thing to do, it was the safe thing to do? Are many people in the Ba'athist Party in that same position, I better be part of this because I have to?
Yeah. Certainly. It was the only way to get a job, or the only safe way to hold a job. There were here and there people who maintained nominal independence and were able to hold jobs, but that was how you were able to get a job. And when you the military and the security services, that represented close to 2 million people who you took jobs away from. And then I remember, for instance, being in June 2003, there were a bunch of army officers demonstrating for their pensions. These guys, because the U.S. had invaded and destroyed their government, were looking, you know, they were trying to collect their pensions. Why should government pensions end just because, you know, why wouldn't the occupation authority continue distributing those? Makes sense. For their trouble, they got shot by U.S. troops during the demonstration. And so you had all of these people lose their livelihoods and then be met with bullets when they went and protested peacefully about it. And suddenly you have a hardcore insurgency, the center of which is the former military and political class. So until somebody starts figuring out a way to bring those people back into the fold, what chance do you have? Somebody, I think it was a soldier, actually, while I was out there on this last trip, just pointed out that you know, you there was never a surrender. No one signed anything. At the end of World War II, you know, we sat down and the Emperor of Japan was forced to sign a surrender. Nobody did that for the Iraqi government. There was no one, you know, they didn't even make Saddam do that before they killed him.
Right.
So you have an open-ended war, and there needs to be some sort of resolution for these people before they're going to put down their weapons.
Well, what is the biggest problem? Of course, the army was disbanded. First of all, my question is to you. If they had left the Iraqi army in place, would that have been the thing to do, even though they were maybe loyal Ba'athist? Would there have been more stability in the country if they'd left that military in place?
Without a doubt.
You think?
Most certainly. Yeah. I mean, Iraqis were... When you ask Iraqis what the U.S. should do, they all say, and they don't really have many ideas about how to do it at this point, we need a strong army to protect our borders. We need a strong police force to protect our cities. We had that before. So yeah, there was, I mean, in the Iraqis all sort of agreed that there was one guy you couldn't piss off, and if you crossed him, you were in a lot of trouble. There were codified laws and other aspects of society that existed that people all more or less agreed on and followed. And so you take that away and you introduce total chaos, well, you've got what you've got. And if, yes, and it's not just the military. For instance, the U.S., and this goes back to when I was reading this article in the Times, it's a great snapshot of what's going on there about the power stations. And the reason that these are so easy to take over now is because the U.S., the central switching station, which controlled power from one office in Baghdad and could direct it all over the country, was destroyed and looted during the invasion. And I visited that office right after the invasion. And the engineers who were there said a U.S. tank literally broke down the doors to the building, and soldiers were shouting, "Go ahead, take your share of the oil," and were followed in by a mass of poor Iraqis who looted the building for everything they could strip out, right down to the electrical wiring. So it's not just the military and the police that we got rid of. We got rid of basic structures of the state, and then we didn't have a plan for rebuilding those.
Well, like has often been said, we had a plan for winning the war, a military plan, but we didn't have any plan for instituting and winning the peace, and that's painfully obvious. The big problem, and you know the propaganda we get in this country now, 9/11, and the fear-mongering that goes on once again, and the reason that we went in, and this new ad that the Bush administration has brought out showing 9/11 once again. Who's the big problem there? As far as the U.S. is concerned, is it truly Al-Qaeda, or is it the sectarian violence? Where would you say is the Americans' biggest problem there right now with the military and all of that? Who's causing the most trouble?
It's the Iraqi guerrillas, some of whom are sort of codified as Al-Qaeda, but who are really just radical, angry Iraqis who are fighting because of the occupation. Al-Qaeda is a minor problem.
Can Al-Qaeda survive in that country if we leave?
No.
Pardon me?
No.
No. The Iraqis won't stand for it.
Not in the sense that for instance, I think a good example is, and this is ironic, because this is the northern Kurdish-controlled area, which was part of the no-fly zone before the war, had a camp of Ansar al-Islam fighters, which is a Kurdish Islamic group, and now has become sort of Kurdish and Arab across the country, that had camps up in the mountains of the Kurdish autonomous area. And these are these are the same kinds of places where the PKK, the Kurdish-Turkish party that's fighting the Kurdish government, also has camps in these same types of areas, these very inaccessible, remote mountains. Those were the terrorists that existed in Iraq before the war, and they were out of reach of Saddam, and they were in very remote areas that were essentially out of reach of the Kurdish security forces as well. And Iraqis don't want those kinds of people there. They're not interested in foreign Arabs. And during the war, they shot in the back jihadis who came from other countries. It's been well documented that Iraqis are very ambivalent toward these guys who came and fought for some greater pan-Islamic ideal. There's an article about a Yemeni jihadi that was in Rolling Stone, I think last year. If people want to look it up, that was a good look at one jihadi, and this was a guy who had fought in Afghanistan and in Bosnia and in Chechnya, and then he went to fight in Iraq, and he had retired after Iraq because he was saying that all of these other places he had been, the mujahideen, were treated as heroes. And in Iraq, he was hiding from the Iraqis as much as he was hiding from the U.S. military. You would have to spend time in a basement and then pop out and do an attack and then go back and hide. And so Iraqis really aren't very interested in having these guys around. And I think the ease with which they've been driven out, as you've seen some of these tribal groups turn against, quote, Al-Qaeda on behalf of the U.S. or on behalf of their constituency, and are now working with the U.S., it's been, wow, it's amazing how quickly these guys drove out Al-Qaeda. What does that tell you about how big the Al-Qaeda presence was? And
well,
suddenly there are no attacks happening. Al-Qaeda's gone. and there are a whole bunch of Southern tribesmen who are working with the U.S. What happened there?
Well, that's all we hear, you know. If we leave, Al-Qaeda is going to take over, and I think thinking
not
people
so
know it's... do you think, and we've only got a couple of minutes left, do you think Iraq will survive as a unified nation, or will it be eventually split up?
It will never be, I don't think, a strong centralized nation as it existed under Saddam Hussein. The Kurds are not going to give up the autonomy they've won out of this. And who can blame them? If I were in their position, I certainly wouldn't either. And it's just quite likely that the central government will never exert the same controls over southern Iraq that it did. If it were to reconstitute itself as such a strong centralized state as it existed under Saddam, that would take a long process of rebuilding the military. I mean, that was, and the security forces, the Mohabarat, the intelligence services that were pervasive inside the country. Saddam had forces that were so large, and that's what kept the country together, and you can't reconstitute that in a matter of years. It will take decades. So I don't think it will remotely be the same country it was.
You mentioned that you're going to teach for a little while?
Yep.
Are you from Michigan originally?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to be teaching at that university in Ann Arbor by any chance?
No, I will be teaching.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm an Ohio State Buckeye, so I'm greatly relieved to hear that.
We'll forgive you for it.
Give us your website, please.
It's www.pulitzercenter.org. Provided a grant for the trip I did, and all of the work from the trip will be linked there.
Great. Pulitzer Center .org?
O-R-G.
Okay, yeah. Good. David, thanks so much. We could have you on for hours, and I appreciate hearing from you and your expertise and your firsthand experience. That's what we need more of. And I appreciate you being on the program very much, and thank you from myself and from all my listeners.
All right, thank you.
Thanks. David Enders, another independent freelance journalist that has nothing but the truth to tell you today, and no reason to tell you anything other than the truth. That's why I appreciate very much having him and Dar Jamil on today. We need to take a step back from what we see on CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox, CNN. We need to take a step back from that and realize what's happening there. And I'm not one of these conspiracy guys that thinks, oh, the media's out to get us. I just don't think they can get the job done. I don't think they are getting the job done. I don't think they have any interest in getting the job done. I think it's all bottom line, and that's why we need to take a step backwards from them and talk to the real people like David Enders and Dar Jamil who've been there. Appreciate very much having both of them on the program today, and we'll have them on again in the future. Now that David's home from Iraq, he's a little more accessible. Speaking of the media, next time you get a chance, take a look at MSNBC's latest ratings out and take a look at Tucker Carlson's compared to everybody else. I should talk, but compared to everybody else, take a look at the MSNBC ratings and take a look at Tucker Carlson's. God, I can't stand that guy. Hey, thanks so much for being with us today. We are so thankful to have our good audience, and from here and to hear all the email that we get from you each and every day. I do want to reiterate that I do my best to try and get back to you as much as I can with our email. It's hard to keep up with, but I do appreciate hearing from each and every one of you. I love the articles you send, and you folks are important. You're the reason we do this program, and we appreciate hearing from you. We really do. Thanks again for being with us here in the Guy James Show today. Don't forget, we're part of the Head On Radio Network. Billy Shears, music director. Be sure and catch his show Saturday night here on the Head On Radio Network. And remember, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. See you later, gang.